I'm grateful to all of you for being here, and I would like to jump right in and say that everything I will say here, I intend as proactive, hands-on tools towards doing whatever we can as individuals, collectively, toward ending the violence for everyone in historic Palestine, making the land river to sea into what it always should have been, a land where everybody, regardless of who you are and regardless of how you got there, plus everybody who, since 1948, has been thrown off the land, can live in peace, equality, and dignity. If anything I say, if any of my ideas don't lead towards that end, by all means, please criticize them in the Q&A. Nothing I say is meant to be merely theoretical or history for its own sake. Now, right off, we face a big problem. We face the problem that whereas all of us here, I'm absolutely sure, categorically condemn deliberate violence against civilians, that is terrorism, no matter who does it to whom, unfortunately, the United States and the so-called West in general do not agree with us and instead finance and arm terrorism in historic Palestine, block any attempt by the UN to stop it, and muzzle us on its behalf. This is so ingrained in us that we self-censor without even being aware of it. And I consider this to be a big problem, even among us who are fighting this cause. And so we need to reinvigorate our voices, freed from the landmines of what we may say and what we may not say, freed from addressing the issue on their terms. And so I'd like to start right off by stepping on a landmine and addressing the most urgent but taboo subject of October 7th, 2023, because that day offers a microcosm of the past century. There remain endless questions about what happened that day, but what is uncontested is that it was the greatest challenge to Israel from within Palestine since 1948, and that the unison response of the West was of such thunder that the slightest hint of curiosity about what happened and why is silenced as complicity in terrorism. In the UK, where I live, people were arrested and convicted on terrorism charges merely for possessing an image of a hang glider, or for suggesting that the people of Gaza have the right to resist. The enforced script goes like this. It was Israel's 9/11. It was a pogrom, summed up with the constantly repeated catchphrase, October 7th was the deadliest day for Jews since the Holocaust. 76 years of manufacturing our consent is contained in this simple mantra. The problem with it is not statistics. The problem is not that many of the Israelis killed were IDF maintaining the siege of Gaza. The problem is not that many of the civilian victims were killed by the IDF, not by Hamas. And the problem is not even the irony that the reason the victims were Jews is that Israel had ethnically cleansed the region of non-Jews and only allowed Jews to settle it. The problem, rather, is the purpose of this mantra and the purpose of atrocity propaganda spread even by the U.S. president. The reason for all of it is to plant the lie that October 7th was rooted in hatred of Jews, reinforcing the carefully nurtured lie that Palestinian liberation is somehow tainted with anti-Semitism. The deadliest day since the Holocaust is a masterpiece of propaganda because its actual messages, that the Palestinians are the Nazis and deserve to be dealt with as such, and that Israel carries in its bosom the moral authority of the Nazis' victims, are hidden inside the mantra, unsaid, yet screamed at us. The irony goes still deeper because it is the Zionists who are guilty of what Hamas is accused of targeting Jews because they are Jews. More on that later. But we are being fed the imagery of Hamas as motivated by hatred of Jews in order to smear the Palestinians with the same brush to numb us to their genocide. The deadliest day since is a particularly cynical example of how Israel exploits the memory of the Nazis' victims in order to further its own racial nationalist crimes in their name. So let's start by separating October 7th into three parts. One, Hamas's breaching of the barrier within which the people of Gaza are trapped. That is to say, its attempt to liberate the concentration camp that is the Gaza ghetto. We are told that this was an attack. Why? Why wouldn't the hang glider be seen as a symbol of liberation? Was the Warsaw Ghetto uprising an attack? Two, Hamas's actions once on the other side of the Israeli wall, which, of course, whatever the truth, must be examined and any crimes condemned. And three, the Israeli state must finally, after 76 years, the Israeli state must finally be held to the same standards to which we hold Hamas. So let's try the experiment. Let's rewind 76 years to see what brought us to October 7th. Gaza is simply a contiguous region of Palestine, a famously beautiful region with a history dating back millennia, until 1948, when Israeli theft of land beyond that to which it had ostensibly agreed in the UN partition severed the region from what became the West Bank. At the same time, the Zionist armies violently uprooted people who lived on land taken by Israel on both sides of partition, but who were not Jewish. And to be clear, not being Jewish was and remains Israel's sole criteria for who it throws off the land or places under apartheid versus those it pays to settle in their place. The common idea of a conflict between Israel and the Palestinians paints a false image, as though this were some real estate dispute for which the Palestinians were eternally dissatisfied. By the end of 1948, many of Israel's victims ended up in Gaza, either pushed there directly or first having been driven into the sea, literally. As Israel cleansed the land of non-Jews, we sat idly by and dubbed the victims refugees, and the hellholes in which they ended up, refugee camps. Now, a refugee camp is a camp for people displaced by war or natural disaster, on account of which are unable to return home. So even during 1948, this terminology was a bit of a stretch. But by early 1949 at the latest, the terms refugee and refugee camp were patently wrong. The displaced Palestinians were perfectly able to go home. They were no longer refugees if the term ever applied at all. Yet they remained in camps, dying from cold, hunger, and disease. Why? The single reason they remained in camps then, and the sole reason they remain in camps today, is that the Israeli state blocks them from going home because they are not Jewish. End of story. So these are not refugees and refugee camps. They are interned people and internment camps. They are Israeli internment camps for Palestinian non-Jews, paid for by the same international community that now pays for their genocide. The refugee terminology instead makes Israel's blocking people from their own homes sound like some tragedy of history for which no one is to blame and about which nothing can be done. And I am not nitpicking semantics. The world accepts that there are refugees and refugee camps. The world does not accept that there are interned people and internment camps. I'm not suggesting that the refugee terminology was a premeditated conspiracy. I am saying that it conveniently fit the needs of the Israeli state and its Western buddies whereas accurate language would have caused the public outrage it should have and made the crime untenable. But we need to use this tool now. Challenging the term refugee camps and refugees forces open the topic of who these people are and why they are in camps, which is relevant throughout Palestine and especially at the moment, obviously, in Gaza. The interned Palestinians no more need Israel's permission to go home than any of us here in this room need Israel's permission to go to our homes tonight. And liberating the camps would change everything, river to sea. Israel's determination that non-Jews would not go home was a key reason why it assassinated the UN mediator, Count Bernadotte, in September of 1948. And it was the Israeli state, not the Stern Gang, as is commonly believed, that arranged the murder. Lehi, Stern Gang assassins, pulled the trigger, yes, but they were working for Ben-Gurion. In early 1949, displaced Palestinians did indeed try to go home, both in Gaza and the West Bank. When they did, they were shot dead on site or captured, tortured, and pushed into the desert. Israel called these people trying to go home infiltrators, and we readily accepted this Orwellian newspeak. The siege of Gaza, which we are told began with Hamas rule, was already in effect, as were Israeli atrocities against these very people it kept interned. Israeli aircraft conducted strafing missions over Gaza as well as the West Bank, and massive ground attacks against Gaza came as early as 1953, when future Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon conducted what a UN body described as an appalling case of deliberate mass murder. These continued, and in 1957, Israel killed hundreds of people in Gaza, quote, in cold blood and for no apparent reason, in the words of a UN committee. The story in the West Bank was the same. The population was kept in a constant state of terror, attack, and atrocity. After the 1967 war, Israel formalized its racial Bantustanization of Palestine by issuing all non-Jews ID cards, assigning them to East Jerusalem, the West Bank, or Gaza. Israel treated the three Bantustans as analogous to heaven, purgatory, and hell. Non-Jews could be forced from East Jerusalem to the West Bank or from the West Bank to Gaza, but they could never go the other way. Since 1948, Gaza has always been Israel's torture dungeon. So the decades go by, and the camps overflow in Gaza, in the West Bank, in surrounding countries, and according to Israel, in Israel itself. One of these internment camps for non-Jews, Shufat, is in East Jerusalem, which Israel claims to have annexed. So, as regards right of return, the people of Shufat don't even need to return. They're already there. Yet, they're in internment camps. The West's so-called peace process has always been a fraud to buy time for Israel, and such was the case with Oslo. Oslo essentially normalized Israeli crimes back to 1948, but in exchange, the Palestinians were told that they could now have their own pseudo-government, the Palestinian Authority. Now, this was little more than shingles hung on doors in Ramallah. It had no power, and instead served as a fig leaf for Israeli apartheid and as a means to have the international community foot the bill for Israel's occupation. And by the way, I'm using the word occupation here in a very specific sense. In general, in our activism, I am against the word occupation. If anyone is curious for my reason, please ask me in the Q&A. Nor did Oslo do anything to ease the constant state of terror in which Israel kept the Palestinians. For a glimpse of that terror, I'll quote from the eminent journalist Chris Hedges, who was in Gaza in 2002, that is, after Oslo and before Hamas. He wrote that he knows war, he had covered many, but until the IDF in Gaza, he had, quote, never before watched soldiers entice children like mice into a trap and murder them for sport. Come 2006, and the Palestinians are told they could hold elections. Of course, we decided who they could choose from, as the most promising leaders had either been assassinated or imprisoned by Israel. And so the choice really came down to Fatah, which had become viewed as corrupt and collaborators, or Hamas, which at the time had proven itself to respond to the needs of the Palestinian people and to be an opposition to Israel. Yet we feigned shock and outrage when the Palestinians, faced with this choice, opted for Hamas. But Israel did not want Palestinian leaders that did not do its bidding. And so, supported by the U.S., it forced this elected government of all of Palestine into Gaza and kept friendly Fatah in power in the West Bank. Israel's noose around Gaza continually tightened, exerting totalitarian control over your life, down to your caloric intake, who you may love, whether your child may get cancer treatment, whether she may play the violin, and whether she may accept the scholarship she won to a prestigious university abroad. Want to feed your family? Well, Gaza has fertile fishing grounds, but the Israeli Navy will kill you if you venture into the more fertile parts of your own sovereign waters, and the sea closer to shore is contaminated because Israel bombed your waste processing plant and blocks its repair. Or you could farm, but you'll be shot dead by an Israeli sniper or remote control tower if you approach Gaza's most fertile grounds furthest from the shore. Meanwhile, Israel uses you, your family, and Gaza's entire trapped population for field testing its weapons, and on any pretext, launches all-out massacres. Israel's carnage against Gaza in the summer of 2014 alone had roughly the same human toll as the 9/11 terror attacks. This is in actual numbers, not adjusted for population. And the excuse for it was every bit as obscene. The U.S. Congress applauded it, and why shouldn't they? After all, it was their massacre as much as Israel's. Israel's guarantee of execution for any attempt by a non-Jew to return home has only tightened since 1948. In the so-called Great March of Return of 2018 to 19, hundreds of people were shot dead or permanently and deliberately crippled by Israeli snipers for a merely symbolic show of just approaching the impenetrable barrier of the Gaza ghetto. To be clear, this did not even rise to the level of civil disobedience. They were confined in the concentration camp in which we've locked them and were murdered merely for symbolism of their most rudimentary human rights. There could be no better proof of the fact of and the futility of Palestinian peaceful resistance, which, by the way, goes back decades and into the pre-state period. Meanwhile, Israel continued to ethnically cleanse people from both East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Thousands of non-Jews in the West Bank continued to be kidnapped and taken hostage by Israel, and hundreds murdered. But Hamas, the government elected to defend them, was holed up in Gaza and denied any conventional means of defense, whether military or political. The only thing it could do was lob primitive rockets over the barrier in protest, most hitting the land on the immediate other side, which is actually, ironically, the home of many of the people interned in Gaza. Yet when 75 years of this pressure cooker inferno blew up on the morning of October 7th, we said with a straight face and an irony that will baffle future historians that there's no excuse for terrorism. One crime we know for sure that Hamas committed that day was the taking of hostages. After 75 years of Israel kidnapping Palestinians, currently holding 10 to 11,000 hostages. Hamas kidnaps a couple of hundred as leverage, and suddenly we learn that nothing can justify it. The question of why our governments will destroy us personally, professionally, collectively, morally, to empower Israel's crimes is a mystery to which I don't have a satisfactory answer, but I don't think we should get sidetracked by it, because our governments are amoral organisms that plow ahead in their own interests. It's not for a lack of understanding or for a lack of information that the Biden administration is conducting genocide. But our governments do require our tacit complicity. So the question becomes, how has the public been kept ignorant of what is being done in their name? Typically, we have fought against the bubble in which we live by exposing Israel's crimes. And this is obviously important. But 76 years of exposing Israel's crimes has not stopped them. It has not stopped them because even when news of Israel's crimes reaches us, we filter it through quote-unquote narrative, that is, sophisticated marketing. Israel has above all been a marketing project. As the USA branch of the Irgun, the terror gang, the Irgun, back in the 1940s described it, they fundraised, their quote, just the way you would advertise Chevrolet motor cars or Players cigarettes. So we need to go beyond Israel's crimes and expose its structures of impunity. How to get us addicted to a product that makes a mockery of every value we claim to hold dear? Well, you would start with an unassailable brand name, Israel, a name that touches a chord deep within our collective cultural subconscious, a word originating in Genesis itself, a place seemingly created by God, a word celebrated in Negro spirituals and praised in church. In short, a name that even the secular among us are culturally wired to honor. And Israel, the modern nation state, openly positions itself as that place, the land's ancient artifacts as the nation state's artifacts, and its settlers as the biblical land's people. Zionism is grand messianic theater. As Ben-Gurion explained cynically in private, without the name Israel, they'd never get enough settlers. Nor would they recruit participants in the theater without Palestine itself, the all-important stage on which this great messianic theater plays out. Now, it's sometimes mentioned that Herzl considered other locations, but he was explicit that these were only meant as stepping stones to Palestine if Palestine could not be gotten at first. So they marketed their state as the reconstitution of the biblical realm in Palestine, reversing the standard settler colonial narrative. Instead of commandeering other people's lands through claims of divine right or manifest destiny, the Zionist narrative was the opposite. They were not settlers, but were simply going home after a hiatus of 2,000 or 3,000 years. Thus, the Zionist genocide is a step beyond even those of colonial Europe, because the Zionist claim of indigenousness requires that it replace the native people not just physically, but also metaphysically, erasing them by expropriating their cultural iconography as its own in order to become the native. It is genocide in its fullest sense. As if, for example, as if Spanish colonizers in South and Central America were to have claimed that all Mayan and Incan and Aztec artifacts and culture and food and music, etc., were actually those of ancient Spaniards, and that the people found there were interlopers with no right to the land. The Zionist resurrection of Hebrew as the vernacular was also necessary for the theater of the messianic return to biblical lands and was imposed by force. It, too, is an ancient artifact serving to place the Israeli state in a protected part of our collective psyche. Hebrew makes the settler, stepping foot on Palestine for the first time, a native of the biblical kingdom. And to criticize someone speaking Hebrew is, in the narrative, to criticize Jews. And like all successful products, the Zionist project needed a logo. And for its logo, it patented the once multicultural Star of David. Zionism also had to assure steady customers. The most successful method to assure steady customers is to create an addiction to your product. And Zionism has managed that brilliantly by turning itself into a cult. More on that soon. And finally, the project needed a slogan. For its slogan, it trademarked the Jewish state. But what does this slogan mean? We accept this trilogy of words, the Jewish state, with little thought. After all, as Israel's defenders tell us, there are Christian states and Buddhist states and Hindu states and Muslim states. And Israel is the only Jewish state, with the insinuation that if you're against it, that must be why. No, this is false advertising. Israel is the only Jewish state, not in the sense that there happen to be no others, but because by Israel's construct, there can be no others. The key word here is the article, the. Israel claims to be the, not a, Jewish state. Its claim over Jews is global and involves ethnicity, DNA, not citizenship. If you're Jewish, it claims to own you. The very sound of the term the Jewish state demands unqualified respect and creates a magic shield, a force field around Israel, warning us not to challenge the state. It shoots its bullets without leaving any forensic evidence, like a talisman that wards off enemies without leaving any trace. For example, I'm sure many of us here have heard the following rebuttal. Why are you always criticizing the Jewish state? But what Israel really means by its slogan is an affront and deserves condemnation. What Israel means by it is the perversion of Jewish identity into racial nationalism. It means that the state must enforce a Jewish majority river to sea, which it defines by blood descent, and preserves this alleged blood purity by way of laws forbidding so-called mixed marriages between a Jew and a non-Jew as defined by the state. All others on the land must remain both a minority and legally lesser human beings. Thus, the Israeli state, by its own self-definition, a definition we have embraced, has no choice but to keep millions of human beings in internment camps. No choice but to maintain apartheid river to sea. No choice but to kill people for the crime of going home while not Jewish, and ultimately to conduct genocide. As long as we endorse the existence of a state based on blood descent supremacy of an imported population, we have endorsed these crimes. If the people of the land simply went home, if people were simply equal under the law, the state would cease to exist, and that is therefore what must happen. No nation state has an intrinsic right to exist. A nation state is a 19th century invention. People, everyone there now, by which, okay, let's include all the settlers, but above all, everyone who has been ethnically cleansed, they have the intrinsic right to exist as equals on that land, river to sea. But Israel has this magic shield around it that other former race states, such as apartheid South Africa, did not. If we put the Israeli state on the allegorical lab table, unscrew the cover, and look inside to see what powers this magic shield, we'll find that its energy source is a hostage. That hostage being Jewish identity. the Israeli state's claim to be the very embodiment of everything and everyone Jewish. Deny Israel this anti-Semitic hijacking of Jewish identity as a human shield, and this seemingly impenetrable armor vaporizes. And that is the key, in my view, to our project. The holding of Jewish identity hostage is the explosive behind Israel's most powerful military weapon, its wielding of the smear of anti-Semitism to silence us, to silence opposition to its crimes. It's a very simple and obvious mechanism. What Israel does, the Jews do. So to accuse the state of crimes is to accuse Jews as Jews of those crimes. But Israel has a big problem on its hands here that we have failed to exploit. Where else have we heard of this direct linkage between the actions of a state and a group? It's a straightforward definition of common bigotry. Racists blame individuals by virtue of claimed oneness between a state and a nationality or a type. And so, an obvious example, during the spread of COVID-19, Chinese-looking people were attacked. Well, because the virus came from China. They, the Chinese, caused COVID. This is classic ignorant bigotry, and we all condemn it. Israel's magic shield works by committing precisely this crime against Jews, but turning it around in order to hold Jewish identity hostage. And instead of condemning Israel for this anti-Jewish racism, we run in fear from it. Other states deflect criticism of their crimes by hiding behind the flag, accusing dissenting citizens of being unpatriotic to the state. Israel instead hides behind the ethnicity, free of borders, accusing dissenting voices anywhere of being traitorous to the ethnicity. Why have we let Israel get away with this? Traditional anti-Semitism, for all its horrors, is powerless to harm the integrity of Jews or Judaism. That is to say, it's powerless to make its libels true. The Israeli state and Zionism, if we accept them at their word, succeed. If we accept their claims on Jewish identity, then we are the common racist blaming Jews as Jews. But through decades of fascistical control, which I will speak about, Zionism has created a cult that believes that, yes, the ideology and the Israeli state are an inextricable part of you, your DNA, part of your identity, not something you have a choice over. And thus, the psychosis of squaring this with wanting to believe that you are a nice, fair-minded person. And unlike conventional cults for which society offers an escape and refuge, this cult has been mainstreamed by way of the amoral politics of convenience of Israel's sponsor states. We must acknowledge that this is what we face, and that the altar of this cult, or altar is the way I would put it, is logically the very fuel that the Israeli state and Zionism need to survive. That fuel is anti-Semitism. Anti-Jewish bigotry is not a disease that the Israeli state seeks to eliminate. It is, rather, the drug to which it must keep the flock addicted. Escaping the cult of the Zionists is, to say the least, difficult. But learning the stories of people who have escaped can only add to courage and confidence. I very much recommend, for anyone who might be interested, I very much recommend a book by Carolyn Karcher entitled Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism, which is a collection of such experiences. Israel needs anti-Semitism, real or imagined, as a permanent state of humanity, and so anti-Semitism has become a racket. For many years, organizations such as the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, the Community Service Trust, the Board of Deputies, or here in the United States, the Anti-Defamation League, have been devoted to maintaining an ever increasing hysteria over anti-Semitism at the expense of the true fight against racism, anti-Semitism included. Without this hysteria, the state loses its supposed reason to exist, loses its law for settlers, loses its main gimmick for fundraising, loses its pretense of facing a never-ending existential threat to justify its crimes, loses its ability to control its devotees through fear, and loses the cry of anti-Semitism to keep us quiet. But why should this tactic work to silence us? What on earth does anti-Jewish bigotry, real or not, have to do with Palestinian human rights? Well, nothing. Nothing. We condemn anti-Semitism as we condemn all bigotry, not because this particular kind of bigotry has anything special to do with us. That is part of Zionism's systematic dehumanization of the Palestinians, and we are harming the cause for justice if we cower to it. But to the practical question, what do we do when we are falsely smeared with the anti-Semitism label? My view, absolute rule, never respond on the terms handed to you. Do not respond with protestations of your innocence, nor with any form of pseudo-apology for anything you didn't do, thinking you will placate the inquisitors. When the scarlet letter of A for anti-Semitism is scrawled on your chest, you should instead correctly boomerang the charge of anti-Semitism back to where it belongs. And it must include the words that the smear was intended to silence. So depending on the circumstance, just to give you an example of what I mean, you might say, now hold on here. I'm just arguing for equality and human rights in Palestine. You are smearing Jews as opposing these human rights? Okay, the court of public opinion might say, okay, the Israeli state may not be perfect, but Zionism and Israel exist to serve the security and emancipation of Jews. That's what they're all about. Well, no. They are about the opposite, and we must start saying so. The historical record makes clear that the actual goal of the Zionist movement, its driving force, was not the welfare or dignity of Jews, but rather the Zionist state itself at the expense of Jews. Jews and others perished at the hands of the Nazis because of Zionism. During the terrible years of the late 1930s through to the end of the Second World War, Zionist leaders consistently fought against safe haven for Jews unless that safe haven was in Palestine. That is, unless it served Zionism. It was not simply a matter of not pursuing safe haven anywhere in safe countries, which already would have been pretty damning, but actively and even violently blocking it. I'll cite one particularly clear example from late 1942, during the height of the Holocaust, involving the efforts of Solomon Schoenfeld, a British rabbi who had been a primary figure in the Kinder transport that had saved many Jewish children on the eve of the war, and that Ben-Gurion, by the way, opposed because the children were going to England, not Palestine. Schoenfeld worked to get the British government to arrange safe passage for Jews who were in Axis territory. I will quote from him. In view of the massacres and starvation of Jews and others, interesting, in enemy and enemy-held territories, he gathered support for a motion for the UK, quote, to declare its readiness to find temporary refuge in its own territories or in territories under its control for endangered persons. Now, this obviously was precisely what the world needed, and inertia for his project grew very quickly. But with passage of the rescue effort in sight, the Board of Deputies of British Jews, a Zionist organization, assisted from the United States by Stephen Wise, president of the World Jewish Congress, a Zionist organization, intervened and sabotaged it and admonished Schoenfeld, quote, in no uncertain terms that they, the Board of Deputies, Wise, the Zionist establishment, would do whatever was necessary to squash government support for the rescue of people from Axis territory. Now, Wise himself had just held a press conference days earlier in the U.S. Capitol to spread the alarm that the Nazis planned the extermination of European Jews. They all knew about the death camps, but the Zionists sabotaged the rescue project because it worked against Zionism. Indeed, it was at about this time that the Jewish Agency, what would become the Israeli government, railed against non-Zionist Jews like Schoenfeld as its enemy. Zionism was indeed a cult in the making. As Britain's war cabinet warned back in the 1940s, quote, any Jew who openly opposes the party line is in personal danger. And indeed, most victims of Zionist assassination, meaning specifically targeted individuals rather than victims of general carnage, were Jews eliminated for opposing Zionism. A 1943 report by U.S. intelligence described Zionism in Palestine as, quote, a type of nationalism, which in any other country would be stigmatized as retrograde Nazism. Indeed, the very same doctrine of blood and soil is being inculcated. It permeates the main Jewish, here meaning Zionist, systems of education. Presciently, the U.S. report stated that anti-Semitism is essential to Zionism. And whereas, quote, assimilated Jews in Europe and America are noted for being stout opponents of racialism and discrimination, Zionism has instead bred a spirit closely akin to Nazism, namely an attempt to regimentate the community even by force and to resort to force to get what they want. The prominent journalist Robert Welch, who had fled the Nazis, warned that Zionist leaders, quote, have not yet understood that the enemy seeks the destruction of the Jews. We, who have been here in Palestine only a few years, we know what Nazism is. The Zionists, rather, are taking part in the crash of European Jewry only as spectators. They do not want to fight against Hitler because his fascist methods are also theirs. The senior inspector of Jewish schools in Palestine, in great secrecy, risked his life to warn about the threat of Zionism, also describing it as a parallel movement to Nazism and alluding to its cult-like nature with warnings about the difficulty of stopping it once it has taken root. Now, I want to clarify that I personally do not make these Nazi parallels unless it is for some specific historical reason. But I cite these British and American intelligence reports to illustrate Zionism's fascistical hold on Jews, leading to the cult-like nature of Zionism today, but also to note that the U.S. and the U.K. fully understood the nature of the project they were supporting all the way back then, pre-statehood. If anyone is interested why I don't make the parallel, please ask me afterwards. Behind closed doors, the Jewish Agency discussed its enemies, and what it considered enemies in the 1940s says quite a bit about the present. Its enemies were democracy, the Atlantic Charter, which of course became the basis for the United Nations, Reconstruction. They were afraid that with the improvement of conditions in Europe, the pressure on Palestine would subside, and they feared a fall in anti-Semitism. Ben-Gurion lamented that, quote, the democracies, in contrast to the dictator states, recognize the Jews as people having full rights of citizenship. And the Jewish Agency blamed what it believed to be declining anti-Semitism in the United States on what it called America's, quote, democratic attitude. Meanwhile, in Europe, the Zionists coerced the Allies to separate Jews from all other DPs, that is, displaced people from the war, into Zionist-run camps, where they were literally brainwashed into the Zionist playbook, such that when a U.S.-UK committee visited the camps in 1946 and asked if they might like to resettle in the United States, which had always been the favored destination, they replied in unison, in absolute terror, that they would commit mass suicide if they had to go to the United States. This is brainwashing. In 1944, U.S. President Roosevelt arranged for safe haven and new homes for 500,000 DPs, more than half of these to be resettled in the United States and Britain. Again, once the plan was headed for success, United States Zionists sabotaged it. Many Jewish children whose parents had perished were being raised in adoptive European families. And so the chief Ashkenazi rabbi of the Palestine settlements, a Rabbi Herzog, ran a kidnapping operation in Europe, forcing the children from their families, making them orphans for a second time, to ship them to Palestine as ethnic fodder. It's important to point out that Herzog's fiercest opposition came consistently from local European Jewish leaders who had the children's interests at heart rather than the interests of Zionism. But Herzog, whenever possible, used political force to circumvent them. The kidnappings were rationalized by others at the time on the grounds that, as terrible as it was to tear the children away from their families, it was understandable that Herzog would want them to be in Jewish families rather than Christian families. As Herzog himself said in justification for what he was doing, he said that for a Jew to be raised as a Christian is much worse than physical murder. Now, think what you want of that in theory, but it too was a lie, because the Zionists stopped Jewish orphans from reaching their Jewish adoptive families in England in order to ship them to Palestine as well. Zionism was over everything. Jews and Jewish suffering were Zionism's fuel for its settler state. That the Israeli narrative now presents Israel and the Zionist movement as the torchbearer of the moral weight of European anti-Jewish persecution and the Holocaust is obscene in the extreme. They are the cynical exploitation of the memory of Hitler's victims, and we should not be afraid to say so, as Israel invokes their memory to help it carry out the same crime of racial nationalism. Even regarding the Allied war effort, the Zionists consistently placed their ideology above the struggle to defeat fascism. It lobbied the Yishuv, the Jewish settlers, not to join the Allied forces because it would not serve Zionism unless Britain formed a segregated Jewish army that was an encumbrance on the war effort, but that the Zionists could use to claim it was an implicit acknowledgement of Jewish nationality and therefore state. The Zionists conducted a massive theft ring of Allied weapons and munitions, as if, to quote one British military record, as if paid by Hitler himself. It continued its terrorism in Palestine, taking resources and personnel away from the war effort. The British begged the Zionists to stop their terror until Hitler was defeated, but to no avail. And by the mid-1940s, Zionist terrorism became the defining daily challenge of life in Palestine. Anyone or anything that kept Palestine a functioning society was a target of the Zionists. Trains, roads, bridges, communications, oil facilities, and Coast Guard stations were constantly being bombed. Utility workers, telephone repairmen, railway workers, bomb disposal personnel were murdered. Police, and especially Jewish police, were long a favored target of the Zionists and were gunned down by the dozens. Among the smaller terror organizations that popped up was one specifically dedicated to Zionists' long-running fear of Jews befriending non-Jews. The ultimate fear, of course, being polluting what for the Zionists was the pure Jewish race. The terror group is said to have doused a disobedient Jewish girl with acid, blinding her in one eye. Zionist terror was aided by the Jewish agency's phenomenal intelligence network. The agency had informers all the way to high placed sympathetic U.S. officials, such that the British learned not even to trust direct messages to U.S. President Truman. Even when UNSCOP, the U.N. committee tasked with finding a solution to the Palestine problem, when UNSCOP visited Palestine in the summer of 1947, the Jewish agency had already replaced the committee members' drivers with spies, had replaced the waiters at the main restaurant they frequented with spies, and most productively sent five young women to serve at what they called a theater network of house attendants at the building where the UNSCOP committee, all of them men, were being housed. The young women were required to be smart and educated, but above all, in the agency's word, they were required to be daring. Now, we don't know what daring meant, but we do know that they extracted a wealth of information from the key people who were about to decide Palestine's future. And with UNSCOP, we arrive at November 1947 and the partitioning of Palestine. When you question Israel's right to exist, you will also be rebuked with its creation myth, that none of today's horror is Israel's fault, because 2 years after the war, the United Nations offered both the Zionists and the Palestinians a state, General Assembly Resolution 181. Israel's founders embraced the offer with gratitude, whereas the Palestinians scoffed at it. In the words of the prominent Zionist watchdog Camera that Soot mentioned, the, quote, "the fundamental fact is that had the Palestinians only accepted partition, there would have been a Palestinian state since 1948, and there would not have been a single Palestinian refugee." Now, the logic itself here is moronic, but let's leave that aside. The idea that the Zionists agreed to partition is fiction. They were fanatically opposed to partition, had been preparing for years to defeat it militarily, and everyone involved knew it. But within the walls of the United Nations, the Jewish agency made a clever chess move. They feigned acceptance of partition because it handed them statehood. Statehood was the single weapon powerful enough to defeat partition, to seize all the land, and cleanse it of non-Jews. Statehood was the key to everything. And this strategy of the Zionists was in effect all along. It actually predates the 1937 Peel Commission, which was the first formal proposal for partition. Chaim Weizmann described the plan to Benito Mussolini when he met with the Italian fascist in 1934. In the interest of time, I will just summarize by saying that the Zionist determination that they would never be a Palestinian state, that they would take all of Palestine at a minimum, they wanted more, and that they would expel the land's non-Jews was explicit and unwavering throughout the three decades from the end of World War I to Israel's self-declaration of statehood and beyond. And that supposed moderates like Weizmann were every bit as fanatical as the acknowledged terror gangs. But there was one possible glitch in their plans, and that would be if the British, or ultimately the United Nations, were to propose a state of all the people, whether a true single state or a binational state, instead of partition. That would make their job vastly more difficult. And indeed, when UNSCOP presented its recommendation, there were two proposals: partition or a binational single state. So, presented with both options, why was a state of all its people the loser? The obvious answer based on history is actually stated bluntly, outright, in British cabinet papers at the time. The answer is fear of Zionist terrorism. The UN selected partition because they knew that if they didn't, the Zionists would have responded with, quote, an intensification of Jewish terrorism. That is, an intensification of Zionist terror beyond that which had already brought Palestine to its knees, and more to the point for the people making the decisions, was increasingly threatening Europe. Now, having selected partition in principle, the UN now had to map this partition. So, how to explain that their partition gave more than half of the land to the Zionists, who, despite the massive influx of settlers, were still a minority? The answer to that lays to rest any lingering question that the UN knew that Israel would ignore partition and that the whole exercise was a charade. Again, quoting British records about the Palestine vote. Quote, "The desire for expansion might develop earlier if the Jewish state occupied a smaller area." So the UN had hoped simply to delay, not prevent, but merely delay Israel's first expansionist war by giving it so much upfront. Now, this appeasement, of course, failed because Israel began its first expansionist war beyond this immediately. And note that it is implicit throughout this that the UN also assumed in advance that its own Security Council would do nothing to stop Israel. Throughout the year before partition, there is consistent proof that both the British and the Americans knew perfectly well that the Zionists planned to ignore partition and that there would be no Palestinian state. Partition was a scam, and above all, the Palestinians, who, by the way, counterproposed with a constitution similar to that of the United States, the Palestinians knew it was a scam. But in the world as it is, statehood is our measure of all things. Having achieved the mantle of statehood, the Zionist terrorism suddenly became Israeli military actions, whereas for the Palestinians denied the podium of statehood, their true self-defense was now terrorism. The cure for today's horror is what should have happened in 1947 to 48, one secular democratic state, river to sea, everyone there now who wishes to become an equal citizen in a shared society. And equality means, by definition, that the internment camps are liberated and every interned person, every refugee, has citizenship in the new state. Yet this idea of simple equality, which we in the modern West claim to venerate, suddenly becomes controversial, scandalous, even hate speech when it is applied to Israel-Palestine. Of course it does, because the simple act of equality would mean the dissolution of the state. Just in closing, for 76 years, we have lamented the disease's ravages while obeying a taboo against addressing the disease itself. And for 76 years, the Palestinians have paid the price. Now, Israel's unbridled savagery has elicited such worldwide revulsion that we can see cracks, finally, in Israel's armor. The cracks hand us an unprecedented opportunity to fight back in the endlessly imaginative ways we can wield the main weapon we have, our voices. First, to stop the apocalypse in Gaza, and then the century-old injustice itself, to which genocide was always not just the inevitable result, but the intended result. This opportunity that we now have has come at a terrible cost, and we must not squander it. Thank you.